You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
This past 4th of July, the family of a British murder victim named Millie Dowler came forward with allegations that messages in the murdered teen's cell phone had been deleted, interfering with the police investigation. With that, a scandal that had been brewing for years erupted, resulting in the shuttering of a newspaper, resignations, and arrests. Joining me now for a look at the implications of the phone hacking scandal is Brooke Gladstone, a host and the managing editor of NPR's On the Media and the author of The Influencing Machine, which is published by W.W. Norton. I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show. Hi.
Hi.
Now, defenders of Rupert Murdoch, including New York's Observer, which is now published by Murdoch, are saying that this is pretty much a tempest in a teapot. How serious do you think it is?
It's very serious. And, you know, when they make charges like this is a witch hunt, like CNN's Piers Morgan, formerly of Murdoch's News of the World, said, it isn't altogether untrue in that it is certainly a media feeding frenzy. But I can't say that its significance is overrated, at least not in Great Britain.
A Wall Street Journal editorial last week suggested that much of the coverage has been politically motivated.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal editorial said, the schadenfreude is so thick you can cut it with a chainsaw. And that may be true, but that doesn't mean it isn't important. This scandal reaches into the highest levels of British government and law enforcement and shows a pattern of collusion between press and politicians that everybody knew about and nobody was courageous enough to really discuss before now.
I was amused by Piers Morgan's response. After all, he's a former editor of News of the World and other British tabloids, a judge on America's Got Talent, now the host of Piers Morgan Tonight on CNN. And he has been accused of participating in similar instances of crossing the line when he was an editor.
Well, it's true. Tuesday's Telegraph, which is another tabloid, reported that members of Parliament want to grill him about his years at the Daily Mirror, when apparently by his own admission, he did a form of hacking that there was at least a form of hacking that might have been involved in one of his biggest scoops. But really, he's been spending a lot of his time defending Rupert Murdoch, talking about how he's shattered, his voice is cracking, the people around him are terribly concerned, he's appalled, and all that sort of thing.
Allegations about phone hacking at News of the World have been simmering since 2002, at least. Why did the matter of the deleted messages from Millie Dowler's cell phone lead to the whole thing boiling over?
Well, it's a child. It's a teenager who's abducted, later found killed. And the reason why the News of the World deleted those messages, apparently, was simply in the course of its own investigation, seeing if anybody would call that would lead to her or lead to the murderer. But they weren't doing it with the police. And the family thought that maybe she was still alive. There isn't a parent on earth that can't feel the agony of that family.
But earlier there had been hacking into the cell phones of the royal family.
Jude Law, Sienna Miller.
Well,
come
Sienna
on.
Miller
is your heart
received £100,000 in a settlement in court. And then it kind of died. And it was after the New York Times published a Sunday Magazine article that some of the charges were revived, and the Murdoch people said, well, this is because the Times sees the Wall Street Journal as its chief competitor, and it was just doing some payback.
Well, you know, I think the reason why it didn't take off simply is being rich and famous is regarded generally as an occupational hazard. Being an abducted 15-year-old is not something you pay for and isn't something that you should have compounded.
There was an internal investigation at News International into the Sienna Miller suit, and executives said that that made them aware that there was phone hacking going on. Could they really have been unaware until they had to pay out £100,000?
Most people don't think so. And the fact is that they've been settling all along. I'm not altogether clear why this particular case is being used as being seen as some sort of trigger point. I mean, following Sienna Miller is her former boyfriend Jude Law and Hugh Grant, who also charged that Murdoch had been hacking their phone
conversations. Not that Murdoch did, but somebody who worked for Murdoch.
Murdoch Papers, exactly. Sorry.
He is saying he can't be aware of what goes on with every one of his many employees.
On the other hand, people who have worked with him say that he has a conversation or has had conversations with editors of the News of the World, his special baby, every single day, and that he wants to be hands-on. And the amounts of money that were paid in essentially hush money is something that he, or at least his son James, who controls many Murdoch properties, ought to have been aware of. In fact, there's a great deal, there are people inside the News of the World that suggest that James misrepresented the facts in front of a parliamentary hearing last week.
They also were paying the legal fees of a private investigator named Glenn Mulcair, who'd gone to jail in 2007 in connection with the phone hacking scandal. Some people say, well, it was just a way of their keeping him quiet.
Yeah, well, you know.
And now they're not going to pay him, and there are rumors that he's going to talk.
Well, I think there's speculation that now that the money flow is cutting off, there's nothing stopping him.
Was it surprising that the Murdochs moved to close the News of the World so quickly? The Dalla family came forward on July 4th. News of the World's last issue was July 10th.
Right. Well, I think that the reason generally is that people think they wanted to preserve their bid to have majority ownership of BSkyB, which is Britain's largest pay TV broadcaster with over 210 million subscribers. And they were hoping that if they covered up this News of the World mess fast, maybe they'd be able to maintain that relationship, but they haven't been able to. They had to withdraw that bid.
Well, the Murdochs and their publications are no strangers to controversy, but have they been handling this one differently?
I think in the past they've always dug in. But as Murdoch said during the parliamentary hearing, the News of the World represented 1% of his – was it 1% or 2%? I think it was 1% of the Murdoch empire. So it wasn't a big loss, and it's an acknowledgement.
But it's one of the most popular papers in England. Still has something like 8 million readers. It's 168 years old. Winston Churchill wrote for it, among others.
Yes, but newspapers aren't what they used to be. Its subscribership, its readership has been sliding along with everybody else's.
Anthony Lane described the cycle of the past in this week's New Yorker as being, and I'm paraphrasing, make a big splash, dubious story or not, see spike in readership, apologize to the outrage, and bet that you'll retain some of the new readers.
Yeah, well, you know, that approach works, but I don't think it works when you're dealing with the agony of an individual family with whom everybody can identify. We don't bleed tears for Sienna Miller.
He also, after they closed down News of the World, Murdoch took ads in a bunch of British newspapers and he apologized. That's something that he has not done in the past. But is this all just, do you think, being a good businessman?
I don't know. I mean, the thing is that he said before Parliament that this was the humblest day of his life, and yet he, when asked if he took responsibility for what happened, he said he absolutely did not. The responsibility lies with the people he trusted and with the people they trusted. So, you know, it may very well be. He's 80 years old. He could be feeling pain. He could be feeling genuine remorse, but he also has a business side. I wouldn't want to plumb the depths of his psyche.
People were looking into that testimony and talking about the long pauses and describing it as perhaps the ramblings of an older man. But then defenders of Murdoch said this has always been his style.
It may very well be. He's been an old man for quite a while now.
From their remarks to the committee, it seemed that the Murdochs, both James and Rupert, didn't have much to do with the daily operations of their papers. You say that's not true?
Well, all I'm saying is that it has been stated that Murdoch would make a call every day to the News of the World. How that extrapolates to hands-on and how it extrapolates to the other papers, I actually couldn't say.
My guest is Brooke Gladstone, who is you're listed as host, not co-host.
I am co-host with Bob Garfield of On the Media,
and also editor. The editor of that wonderful NPR show WNYC produces, and she's the author of The Influencing Machine, published by W.W. Norton. Congratulations for being on the Colbert Report last night. Colbert Report.
Yes, he turns out to be a very sweet guy.
Now, did you talk at all about Murdoch when you were there?
No. In the expanse of 6 minutes that I had on that program, which is the standard, mostly you try and cram in as much information as you can about the book in between his jokes.
I was thinking about whether a similar scandal at the National Enquirer, and there have been any number of them, would have led to this kind of uproar.
No, it wouldn't, because the National Enquirer in no way approaches Murdoch's properties and the man himself in power and range.
Because Murdoch has connections to the leaders of both parties in Britain. One of his editors from News of the World, Andy Coulson, became spokesperson for the prime minister, the current prime minister, David Cameron. Now this whole thing is expanded into a scandal at Scotland Yard.
That's right. Coulson is now arrested. Scotland Yard had also hired a former News of the Worlder as spokesperson. That person is gone. There have been resignations at Scotland Yard, and there are clear and very persuasive allegations that Scotland Yard took money from News of the World in order to facilitate or cover up the hacking.
But this actually is similar to some of the things we've discussed about this country, the coziness of many people in the press with powerful political figures. In this case, you have Rebecca Brooks, who was also a top figure in News International, one of the editors of News of the World, being her husband went to school with the prime minister. Both Tony Blair and David Cameron came to her wedding. And we wonder about whether politicians sometimes bend over backwards for people in the press because they want to get good coverage, and vice versa, people in the press giving good coverage to people that they've had dinner with.
Of course. It's happened all the time. The first American politician to wine and dine press people in order to get them to report his way is George Washington. It is as old as the nation, and it will be forever thus. The question is we may not like that coziness, but when does coziness become collusion? It is clear that the power of the Murdoch papers could make or break a prime minister in an election season, which is very brief in Britain. And so, going back to Thatcher, it was widely believed that the Sun helped get Thatcher elected. This is a relationship that has no comparison in the United States.
Although Rupert Murdoch has used the New York Post over the years to promote candidates and to hurt candidates, and Fox News, no matter what anybody says, does seem to have some kind of a bias, a political bias.
Absolutely. But they can't, and they have certainly affected the national dialogue and the national debate. That's what the media do. But, is Fox News going to get Sarah Palin elected? I don't think so.
They will keep her in the public eye.
They will. They will. And, there are questions about their protestations of fairness and balance, and certainly we could go down that path. But it's a question of, are there countervailing forces? Can they buy a position? Can they create one because of this influence over a majority of the people? And they just can't.
I'm talking with Brooke Gladstone, co-host and managing editor of NPR's On the Media and the author of The Influencing Machine, which is published by W.W. Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Brooke Gladstone, who's co-host and managing editor of NPR's On the Media and also the author of The Influencing Machine, which is published by W.W. Norton. And this story has gotten a tremendous amount of coverage here in the United States, probably second only to the negotiations over the debt ceiling. Is that because of Murdoch's importance to American media?
No. I think it's because it's about journalists, and journalists really can't resist a story about other journalists. It's, you know, it does have
And that's what your show is based on. On the Media is about journalists examining the state of journalism.
That's right. I'm in my 11th year of picking the fluff out of my navel. But, you know, this is a case where, and there was a very interesting Pew study about this. It was the second most story covered last week or the week before last, just as you said, after the debt ceiling. And, yet it was something like fifth story after women's World Cup soccer and other things in the interest of the news consumer. So there's definitely a disconnect there between American people's interest in the story and the American media's interest in covering the story.
But some people have called this the British Watergate. I suspect during Watergate, Perhaps a World Series got more attention.
We're talking soccer here, Lenny, soccer. And it may well be the British Watergate. I don't know, but it's not the American Watergate. And in some precincts, it's being covered as if it were.
You mentioned during the break that we have had similar wars in the United States, because this is also about scooping. Murdoch was very upset when other newspapers scooped his newspapers on big stories. And I guess there was a lot of pressure to do this kind of phone hacking because that's the best way to scoop. Actually.
That's absolutely true. There have been tabloid wars ever since there have been tabloids. And if you judge by the actual size of a paper when it became more square, that actually began happening at the end of the 19th century in the United States. And the war in New York between Hearst's tabloids and Pulitzer's tabloids resulted in behavior that was actually far worse than that was perpetrated by the News of the World. Reporters, there was a murder here in New York in the summer of, I think it was 1896, and involving body parts showing up all over New York. And reporters were literally keeping other reporters from sites, even the police. They would cut phone lines so competing reporters couldn't phone in their stories. They intercepted letters and got them to the editors of the tabloids rather than to the people for whom they were intended. This is an exact analogy to phone hacking.
But nobody is suggesting that this sort of thing is going on in this country, even though, as you showed on the media this weekend, hacking into phones isn't all that difficult. Are reporters here held to a different standard?
I believe that they are. And in fact, I don't know if, like anything that you do in journalism, the question is why are you doing it? What are the stakes? When you break the law, what are you after? I mean, I have to say that I am not necessarily joined by my fellow media critics in suggesting that sometimes breaking the law is okay. You have to pay the price for breaking the law, but it might be worth paying that price to expose danger to the food supply in the United States or to expose an enormous corporation's mistreatment of its workers, as in the Chiquita coverage at the Cincinnati Post a decade ago. I think it was 12 years ago. The paper ended up recanting because there was phone hacking involved, but the reporting was good, and Chiquita was never held to account.
I just read something where somebody compared this to WikiLeaks and said that liberals are jumping on Rupert Murdoch's back at the same time that they are defending Julian Assange. But
a leak is not a leak is not a leak. I mean, when Julian Assange, they aren't, you know, those organizations, certainly the New York Times, does not defend Julian Assange. It takes its information where it gets it, it vets it, It selects it for importance, and then it posts it within context. It reports it within context in according to the standards of good journalism. That's not what Julian Assange does. And if Julian Assange turns out to be the source of information, once it goes through the proper vetting, it is, and it's deemed valuable to the American people, it is not the same as hacking Millie Dowler's phone. And anybody who says it is being profoundly cynical.
Although we've seen a lot in the press where somebody's phone is hacked, the story comes out, and then every other newspaper now can report the story.
True. I remember when we were covering Clinton, NPR, the Clinton-Monica Lewinsky scandal, I should say, NPR did not want to cover the dress that was soiled during the course of their affair, but then they assigned it to me to cover the reporting of the soiling of the dress, which I thought was actually a little craven.
News International is suggesting that they weren't the only ones on Fleet Street who were engaged in this kind of activity.
Yeah. So what?
Yeah. Well, how you on the media, you John Keefe of WNYC, our news director, explained how you can hack into a phone for just $10.
Oh yeah, there's a service where you can. All you have to do is plug in a phone number. And they will essentially create the user ID for you, and you can get into the phone messages of whosever phone number that is. It's very cheap, and it's very easy. If you want to prevent this from happening, you need to use and make sure that you put in a password before you can access your own messages, and services like AT&T don't require that you do that. You can do it if you choose to, but if you don't want to put in the four-digit password, you are prey to services like this very easily.
Although it's also been pointed out that it's easy to figure out those passwords if you want to. In the case, I just wonder whether Rupert Murdoch has a password or not. Some of our listeners have been writing in to talk to Brooke Gladstone, who is the co-host and managing editor of NPR's On the Media. Her book, The Influencing Machine, has recently been published by W.W. Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm London Lopate. Peter in Brooklyn writes, because of the way campaigns are financed in England, that the financial playing field is more level, it would seem that the media wields more power than in America. Can you discuss the power of the media in both countries in relation to campaign financing?
That's fascinating. I wish I knew more about it. I do know that with the passage of new laws here, there is an unlimited amount of corporate money that can go into campaigns. And, of course, the majority of that is spent on media. There, you know, the media coverage is something that the media organizations themselves have more control over because the financing is more controlled. So I think that, yeah, the writer is right. The media organizations there do wield a great deal more because corporate financing is that much less. There's less competition.
A number of people have been arrested. I wonder if they would have been arrested in this country.
Yeah. No, if they're breaking the law, I'm assuming that they would have been arrested in this country.
Well, there have been a lot of resignations at the Metropolitan Police, at News International, at News Corp. Has that helped contain the scandal for the time being, do you think?
I think what most people there are saying is that this scandal is going to ebb and flow. If convicted hacker Mulcair begins to talk, if a bunch of emails that a hacker got hold of related to News Corp are released, then there'll be more allegations. There'll be more investigations. At this point, Parliament wants to call James Murdoch back because of misstatements that he apparently made. And of course, there are FBI investigations opening up in this country.
There have been comparisons made between the way James Murdoch and Rupert Murdoch and Rebecca Brooks and others were questioned in committee hearings in Parliament as opposed to the way it's done here. And I've read both sides complimented and criticized the Americans for all of the opening statements and the posturing of politicians. On the other hand, the British questioners seem to be asking really softball questions.
Some did, some didn't. Some were
really... Well, not much came out of this. There wasn't much follow-up.
It is true that Rupert and James were able to stonewall these guys. But I don't think it was for lack of direct questioning. Some of the questioning was so specific that it was almost laughable. And the rest of the time, if people say, I don't know, I don't remember, that was somebody else, what do you do until people like former employees of the News of the World come forward and say, no, that's not how it happened. And that is what is happening now. Those people are coming forward.
Well, one of the most important figures in this story, Rebecca Brooks, admitted that she had bribed people at the Metropolitan Police, but then she couldn't remember any specific incidents and details.
Well, maybe those memories will come back to her.
It is interesting that reporters suddenly have such poor memories.
I don't even know what day it is.
David Cameron, of course, is the one who is sweating most right now. He seemed to be doing okay, and this is really hurting him.
He's riding it out. It's unclear how much the fact that Rupert Murdoch was ushered into the back door of 10 Downing Street or attended a Christmas dinner is going to ultimately affect David Cameron. I think that we'll have to see whether absolute illegality gets connected directly to him.
Just one more thing, which is something you alluded to earlier. Would any of this matter if the public didn't respond so positively to the kinds of stories that were broken?
You mean if the public didn't love celebrity hacking stories or if they weren't so horrified by the Millie Dowler story? I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, up until the Millie Dowler story.
Mm-hmm. If it didn't sell papers, is what you're saying.
It obviously was selling papers.
Yeah, but guess what? Not fewer and fewer papers as time went on. As the competition among tabloids got hotter and hotter in England for a smaller and smaller share of the British population, actually it just continued to decline, and they've been hemorrhaging readers in the last few years. So one can't even argue for sure that this technique is a surefire newspaper seller anymore.
Actually,
there are other places you can go to for these things now.
Actually, I remember reading that when Murdoch bought the News of the World, its circulation had gone down from 9 million to 7 million, but its circulation when it was closed was 2.5 million, and that was considered very high.
Exactly. That was the biggest selling paper in Britain, and it was a shadow of its former self.
So it's really, this as much as anything, is also a reflection of the fact that newspapers in general are in serious decline.
Yeah, I mean, you can get your celebrity gossip anywhere.
Why would Murdoch even care about owning all these newspapers? He owns so many. The Post is hemorrhaging money. He's making so much from his film studio, from his cable networks, his television. If B Sky B hadn't suffered this crisis, just bad timing, he would have been making a lot of money from that as well. Why do you think he still wants to own these newspapers?
Everybody says that he loves newspapers. He loves the business. He has ink in his blood. And that's a passion that he can afford to indulge because he has so much money to do it. I mean, a lot of people will acknowledge that the Wall Street Journal was in terrible financial shape before he came back to, infuse it with cash, and it is on much more solid financial footing now, even though we might question, what it's doing on its editorial page. The editorial page is always, by its very nature, an opinionated part of the paper, and the reporting elsewhere is good.
Thanks so much for being on our show, Brooke.
It's my pleasure, Lenny.
Brooke Gladstone is co-host and managing editor of NPR and WMIC's On the Media, the author of The Influencing Machine, which has just been published by W.W. Norton. Go out and get a copy immediately.
Thank you, Lenny.
And thank you.